You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Perseverance rover is making its first moves on the surface of Mars since touching down last month. We'll talk to a space writer about how it will search for evidence of ancient life. Now, President Biden signed the American Rescue Plan Act yesterday. Included in the recovery bill is an increase in the child tax credit. Many families could receive $3,600 for kids under 6 years old and $3,000 for children between the ages of 6 and 17. Researchers say the measure could lift 13 million Americans out of poverty, reducing it by a third. We're looking at this legislation and its possible impact on poverty. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been hit hard financially during the pandemic, struggling to care for your kids? Are you living the paycheck to paycheck? Will this child tax credit help? Or do you want to know if it will help? Do you have questions about how it works and the kind of impact it might have? And what do you think of this kind of policy? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sarah Halpern-Meekin is an associate professor of human development and family studies at UW-Madison School of Human Ecology and the La Follette School of Public Affairs. She specializes in social and welfare policy and families living in poverty. Sarah, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, a lot of attention has been paid to the straight-up checks being sent out to a lot of people around the United States. Can you tell us, Sarah, about this child tax credit, what it does in comparison to the existing tax credits?
Sure. So people might be familiar with the child tax credit that's currently in existence. Families were eligible to get up to $2,000 as a tax credit, and it was partially refundable. So if you had, if you didn't owe any money and they owed you money, they'd send you a check. There are some key changes from that old policy to this new policy. So first, it expands the availability of that policy to families that were excluded or limited from that maximum benefit before. So if your earnings were not above a certain level before, you weren't eligible for any or part of that $2,000 credit. So there are more families that are going to be eligible. Previously, the children, families of about a third of American children were excluded from getting at least that full benefit. And so that's going to affect a lot of people. In addition, the payments, as you said in your opening, are larger. So for children who are 6 to 17, their families are eligible for up to $3,000. And for children under 6, they're eligible for $3,600. And then there is one other key difference, which is that this legislation has directed Treasury to figure out a way to make these payments periodic, so that families will get checks monthly from July through December, as opposed to just getting that one big check at tax time.
I want to give a listen to President Biden addressing the nation last night after signing this plan into law. Here he is talking about the anti-poverty impacts of a lot of the different measures, not just the child tax credit. Here's a listen.
That means a typical family of four earning about $110,000 will get checks for $5,600. Deposited if they have direct deposit or in a check, a treasury check. It extends unemployment benefits. It helps small businesses. It lowers health care premiums for many. It provides food and nutrition, keeps families in their homes. And it will cut child poverty in this country in half, according to the experts.
All right, cutting childhood poverty in half. What do you see, Sarah, as the impact when it comes to poverty of, again, not just the child tax credit, but the overall Recovery Act?
Right. So the poverty line for, let's say, a family of three is just below $22,000 a year. And so that means if a family's income falls below that line, they're considered to be in poverty. And so when we're looking to see, you know, do these policy changes lift people out of poverty, we're asking, will this difference in income lift them above that threshold? And the simulations that I've seen show that we would expect the policy changes that we have here to cut child poverty by 40 to 50% by raising the incomes of families who are below that poverty line so they end up above that poverty line. But I think there's also one other important thing to pay attention to. There are going to be families who aren't lifted above the poverty line, but who might be lifted out of extreme poverty or deep poverty. So they might still be in a difficult financial position, but they're going to be doing a lot better than they would have been in the absence of this money.
Talking to Sarah Halpern-Meekin from UW-Madison School of Human Ecology, looking at the poverty-related impacts of this new big COVID relief package signed into law yesterday. You could join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. What do you think in particular of the idea of these child tax credits to people living in poverty? In effect, the rebate, getting these rebates, do you think this is a good anti-poverty measure or not? 800-642-1234. Now, Sarah, these the checks, the direct stimulus checks are a one-time thing. The tax credit, as I understand it, is this year only because of the nature of the bill. Does the fact that this is a non-recurring thing, it's not going to be from year to year at present, does that make a difference?
Absolutely. So the policy changes just for a year in the American Rescue Plan. And so I would expect that the changes to child poverty will likely be similarly temporary if the policy isn't extended. You know, we've seen families experience an increase in their income over the past year in response to different, different congressional acts. So previous stimulus checks, previous increases in unemployment insurance have lifted families up during this tough economic time. But when those go away, the help that they offer to families go away, too. And so unless we see a continuation of this through new legislation, I would expect that we would see child poverty rates rise once again.
One criticism of this kind of measure is, okay, if people are getting these kind of credits now, is it a disincentive for them to seek out jobs even as the economy recovers and hopefully jobs continue to come back? Do you worry about that concern about disincentivizing finding jobs?
So when I look at the research, it doesn't show that payments of this size are likely to lead a lot of parents to leave the workforce. We can look, for example, at payments that folks in Alaska receive due to their oil reserves called the Alaska Permanent Fund. So everyone in Alaska gets a check every year through this Alaska Permanent Fund. And the research shows that there aren't big disincentives that exist, that people don't largely turn away from employment in response to receiving that money. I think there are the money is not enough, not nearly enough to live on comfortably in our society. And we also want to keep in mind that people work for reasons other than financially having to, as we see, you know, many dual income, high earner parents where they could get by on one income and choose not to. But I think this question, we also want to think really hard about whether we want to frame it as, is it always bad if parents work less? We should think about whether we want to consider parents spending more time with their children, maybe cutting back on working hours or something like that, as necessarily bad. We tend to, in our society, view less employment as inherently bad, but that's because we define all the time and that parents spend taking care of their own kids as not being work. And I think, as any parent knows, it certainly is work, and it's a whole different kind of work. So we might want to think harder about whether we want to ask that question in that way.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Patrick is with us in Wild Rose. Patrick, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What'd you want to bring up?
Just like concerns curiosity as far as, you know, it all sounds good, this tax child. Yeah, I have three kids. I'm a single father. And, speaking to the points of people working more, when they really don't have to, that I love hearing that, because it'd be great if our society could change a little bit culturally that way and take a little more time with our children, because they need to be fed spiritually way more than they do materialistically. But the $3,000 tax credit, my concern is giving somebody $3,000, that's not going to raise them out of poverty. On paper, it's going to raise them out of poverty, but if they're just given $3,000, I know people with college educations that are going to go blow that on a new cell phone or you know, giving that $3,000 tax credit, I see a lot of drugs and alcohol being bought with it.
Patrick, thanks a lot for the call. And Patrick brings up, Sarah, I mean, a common concern of, I guess, old-fashioned, what we think of as welfare or direct payments, that it will be spent in ways that some might consider frivolous or outside the best interest of the person receiving money and of society.
Yeah, this is definitely, you know, the issue Patrick brings up here is one that we hear fairly often. I think there are a few things to address there. First is that the research that you know, my team has done and that others have done show pretty consistently that people are generally not using their money in those ways, especially when people have very limited income. They need money to keep a roof over their heads and to keep clothes on their kids' backs and to keep food in their kids' bellies. And so the option to go blow $3,000 on a cell phone, for example, just doesn't really exist for most people. The other thing I think we want to keep in mind is we tend to get really critical of financial decisions that low-income people make in a way that we are not critical of the financial decisions that higher-income folks make. And I think we should question that, you know, if somebody is allowed to take their tax refund and go spend it in the ways that they choose, if they're middle or upper income, without scrutiny, we should afford that same dignity to people who happen to have lower incomes.
Thanks for the call, Patrick. We're talking to Sarah Halpern-Meekin, Associate Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at UW-Madison. We're looking at the recently passed American Rescue Plan and how it could affect poverty, especially for children. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts on what should be done to address child poverty in the United States? Do you have questions about this year's increased child tax credits as passed in that bill signed yesterday? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Sarah Halpern-Meekin. She researches poverty at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you support increasing child tax credits to help parents through the pandemic? That's part of the American Rescue Plan signed into law yesterday. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions. Let's go back to your calls now. Rose is with us in Cumberland. Rose, hi. We lost Rose. Okay. Sorry about that. Maybe Rose can try calling in again. So, Sarah, I wanted to ask about, are there other policies that you think might be effective, maybe even more effective in targeting child poverty?
Well, I think the American Rescue Plan has a lot of components in it that are going to affect families up and down the income ladder, just like the child tax credit does. So it's not just targeted at poor families. And similarly, a lot of the other changes that we see in the American Rescue Plan are going to send funds to families who are in a really tight situation now. So that includes, for example, an expansion of funds focused around child care centers and child care needs, which I'm sure, you know, any family who's sent a child to child care knows it's really expensive. And anyone who's running a child care center knows, you know, margins are tight. So that's one area of this legislation that we can pay attention to. There's also money in the bill to focus on issues around heating assistance, issues around, you know, helping people pay their rent and make sure that they don't face eviction, and also, you know, food assistance, so continuing the expansions of food assistance that we've seen, as well as a whole lot of other things around health insurance, helping schools get back to work, helping state and local government, and also, you know, spending a lot of money helping us deal with the pandemic in terms of ensuring that there's adequate personal protective equipment, there's resources to ensure the distribution and access to vaccines, those sorts of things. So there's so much in this legislation that I think we still need to unpack in terms of how those pieces of policy are going to come together to affect families.
We have Rose in Cumberland back now. The problem is on our end. Sorry about that. Rose, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up, Rose?
So I think this is a great idea. I think it is going to help families. We're a family of six, and my husband and I both work full-time, and I also have two extra part-time jobs. So I think this is going to be good to help us for right now, but in the long run, it really isn't, because once this extra money goes away, we're going to have to pick up those two or three extra part-time jobs to try to make ends meet. And we do spend less time with the children because, you know, I'm always working or my husband's always working. So it's very rare that there's two of us always around. So if they would focus these to be more to go just to our rent or just to the electric and not just, you know, here's $3,000. And like a previous caller said, that he knows people that could spend it on phones or drugs. And I know some people that they plan their vacations around tax time because that's when they're getting a big chunk. You know, they're not saving it for August and September of this coming year for winter bills.
And Rose, I wanted to ask, childcare costs, is that something that's, you know, not even a reality for you? Or is there any kind of affordable childcare to help you when, as you say, you're having to work extra jobs?
Well, we do get childcare assistance because we are low income and we'd still have to pay out of pocket. And it's still very expensive. And we just have the two kids in daycare. I mean, some people have four or five kids in daycare. And if you really break down the numbers, they're only making maybe $9 an hour. And if somebody's taking care of my child, I think they should be making a lot more. But then on the flip side, then I can't afford childcare.
Rose, thanks a lot for that call. And Sarah, I did want to bring up the childcare issue. There was talk, there's been talk over for years. Do we need more assistance for families to be able to afford childcare, while, as Rose said, paying the childcare workers a decent wage? Where do you see that as part of the puzzle?
Well, we can look at the fact that this has expanded benefits more for children who are under six. And, you know, as Rose was speaking to, right, having kiddos in daycare is really expensive. And so the higher benefit levels for for families with younger children reflects the fact that we know that families are shouldering a lot of costs around raising young children. So whether that's buying formula and diapers or paying for childcare, there are a lot of additional costs that families can't avoid taking on when they have young children. And so the higher benefit levels sort of speak to that need.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Bob now, calling from Northern Illinois. Bob, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to bring up, Bob?
I wanted to bring up that I think most of what we're doing is not really going to ever fix the problem, because we keep having an increase in population and a decrease in jobs and an extra burden on our livelihood. So we're just kind of not addressing the problem through tax credits and inflation. We should kind of protect, number one, our home people, first of all, and take care of us first, so then the cost of living goes back into correction, the cost of insurance goes back into correction, because every year it costs me more and less time spent with my kids, because the housing goes up from a shortage of housing while the wages go down from an abundance of wage earners. The mathematical equation is very simple. We're doing it wrong.
Thanks for the call. Sarah, Bob's seeing a structural problem. We have seen wage stagnation, especially for people at the bottom of the economic ladder, while costs don't hang out down there with those wages. What do you think?
It's absolutely true that, you know, the value, for example, of the minimum wage has not kept up with inflation. The very ways that we measure poverty have not kept up with inflation. So the real kind of value of the, you know, the dollar figures that we peg the poverty threshold at, they haven't kept up either. And so families who are poor today are poorer in a sense than families who were poor when we were measuring 50 years ago. So there's definitely a lot of structural changes, like Bob is speaking to, that are tied up in these issues. I think we can always question whether any particular, you know, one piece of legislation, even one as expansive as this, is going to address all of the issues that society is facing. And, you know, I think as Bob was arguing, it's not, there's not one piece of legislation that's going to fix all of society's issues. So I think the question that we want to discuss is this, does this move in the right direction? Is this going to help alleviate suffering or help, you know, promote well-being, and then move forward from on the discussion from there?
On the practical side of things, Sarah, are these benefits automatically going to go to people who they apply to, or are people going to have to, at least in some cases, step up and say, yes, I'm eligible, let me know how to get this?
So my understanding of the legislation is that if you file taxes in 2019 or 2020, you will automatically receive these monthly payments, supposed to start in July. So it's an opt-out situation where if you have filed taxes, they will use that information that you've shared previously by filing taxes to send you the right amount of money starting in July. If you did not file taxes in 2019 or 2020, you will need to tell the IRS that you have dependent children, and you will need to claim this benefit in order to get those monthly payments. So for families who have not been filing taxes in recent years, they're going to need to do something in order to access this money.
And do you see any kind of outreach campaign? I know this thing just got passed into law, but do you see a need for outreach to make sure it reaches those people?
So I definitely think there are going to be a lot of families who will have barriers to requesting this money. So first, you know, the IRS is going to be charged with setting up some kind of internet portal where families can put in their information so that they can receive these benefits. We know, you know, in Wisconsin in particular, there are lots of areas where we're still dealing with broadband issues. Families might not have internet access. And so figuring out how we can let families know that this money exists and what the process is for filing for it, and then helping them have access to the infrastructure so that they can file for it, is something that community agencies are going to need to pay attention to.
Sarah, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Sarah Halpern-Meekin is an associate professor of human development and family studies at UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. She joins us for a look at measures in the new economic recovery bill aimed at bringing children out of poverty. Perseverance rover touched down safely on Mars just under a month ago, and it's already getting to work. It sent back pictures and videos of its landing site, and if you've ever wondered what a laser shooting rocks on another planet sounds like, now we know. That laser is just one of the many tools on the rover that NASA will be using to search for evidence of ancient life on the planet and hopefully collect rock samples that will make it back to Earth. Mike Wall is a senior writer for Space.com and author of the book Out There, a scientific guide to alien life, antimatter, and human space travel for the cosmically curious. We talked with him earlier today. Well, now the rover landing was exciting. I know a lot of people are on the edge of their seats. What was it like for you watching, you know, someone who follows these things, watching it land and land successfully?
It's so nerve-wracking because, I mean, I've been covering this for a long time. This mission had been in development for basically 10 years, and you just know how much is actually riding on it. And I mean, I just can't imagine what the people on the mission were feeling who had devoted 10 years of their lives to this. But just as somebody who cares about space and wants us to see cool things happen, yeah, it's like a 7-minute process where it goes, where it hits the atmosphere and then lands, and like everything has to go perfectly. And we all have no control over it, right? We're just waiting to hear updates. And yeah, it's just totally nerve-wracking. And then it all went well, and it was all great.
And speaking of having a lot riding on it, there are a lot of different types of scientific technology riding on this rover. What are some of the big ticket items that are being fired up or already working right now?
Yeah, well, there are two main sort of mission goals. One is to hunt for signs of sort of ancient Mars life on the surface of Mars. So that's one of the first things that the rover is going to do once it gets fully up and running, which it's like almost there. And then the like second goal is to actually collect like about 30 or so samples that could could tell us a lot more about like ancient Mars and maybe even like whether it hosted life. And those samples are due to be picked up by a future mission campaign and brought back to Earth, potentially as soon as 2031. And that's really exciting too. You know, I mean, like I mentioned, there's a lot riding on this mission, and that's one of the things is it just kicked off this like first ever Mars sample return campaign, where hopefully if everything goes right, we're going to get pristine pieces of Mars that were chosen for their potential to support life or to like harbor signs of ancient life. And we're going to get those pieces of Mars back on Earth. And that's really, really cool. It's never been done before.
Now let's talk about this hunt for signs of past life on Mars. This isn't like an archaeological expedition where you're going to find the remnants of buildings and ceramics and maybe even bones. Talk about the subtle clues that we're hunting for that'll tell us, yes, there was in fact, if they find it, there was maybe life on Mars.
Yeah, these are not going to be little green men, at least we don't think so. What they're looking for are sort of like microbial fossils. And I mean, it could be morphological things, you know, like some sort of like molecular fossil imprint in a rock, or it could be chemical fossils, you know, it could be like organic molecules, which themselves don't necessarily have to be signs of life. But if you gather enough of them and they're the right type and in the right sort of conglomeration, they can be. Or what's most likely, it's going to be a combination of those things. You know, what does it look like and what's the chemical composition? But it's just really interesting, you know. So that's what the rover is going to be doing by itself on Mars. And it's probably going to be hard to come up with like a sort of slam dunk case for whether what the rover sees on Mars is a convincing sign of past Mars life. And people are going to be arguing about this. It could be like the biggest scientific discovery of all time, theoretically, if it happens. And that sort of goes to why they want to do Mars sample return too, because scientists know that it's going to be really hard to get a convincing case for Mars life by Perseverance by itself on Mars. So we want to bring that stuff back and have a bunch of scientists around the world look at it with all their equipment and labs around the world. And they're sort of thinking, you know, it would be great if life ever did exist on Mars, it'd be great if Perseverance could find signs of it. But they're not getting their like hopes up to that extent. They're sort of saying it's going to be hard for Perseverance to do that by itself, which is why we need samples back here on Earth.
Talking to Mike Wall, senior writer for space.com, authored the book Out There, looking at the Perseverance mission, the rover on Mars, and what it is up to now and the plans for the future. Mike, Perseverance has a laser, and it's using lasers to shoot rocks. I mean, one question is, why would you not shoot a laser at rocks on Mars if you had the possibility? But what are we doing? Why are we lasering rocks there?
Yeah, that's part of its like scientific, you know, like sort of toolkit, what it's using to investigate composition of rocks. And so it can use this laser from afar, from distance, basically. It can investigate rocks without having to drive over to them. So what it does is this like laser can shoot rocks up to 20 feet away, and it like vaporizes a tiny little patch of rock. And then like scientific gear that's associated with the laser instrument can kind of like study that little cloud of vaporized rock and see what the composition is. So like it can actually get the composition of rock from far away. And then either that's enough for the science team. They're like, okay, that's like, we know what that rock is, or, ooh, that's interesting. Let's go over there and investigate that rock with our other instruments, because that's really interesting. So it's sort of like, it gives them an idea of what targets they would like to investigate more in depth with the other stuff too. And what's like really cool about that laser instrument is it's actually got a microphone on it. And just a couple of days ago, like the Perseverance team released like some of the audio of the laser hitting rocks. It sounds like a bunch of little snaps. It goes like snap, 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 snap. And those are the shock waves that are created by the vaporization of that rock. And it's just really cool. That's another first of this mission. It's got two microphones on it, and both of them have actually recorded sounds on the Martian surface, which had never been done before.
And on top of all that, there's a mini helicopter. I gather they're looking for a good landing and takeoff spot for it now. But talk about this mini chopper on Mars.
Yeah, it's just amazing how much stuff is on this rover, right? There's so many things to talk about. This is actually the first big ticket item, or the first big project that the mission is doing after they get the rover fully up to speed. It's carrying this little like 4-pound helicopter on its belly, and what Perseverance is doing now, it's already started scouting out like a suitable airfield for the helicopter, you know, a nice flat area where there aren't many hazards and it'd be safe for this thing to fly. And so sometime in the spring, once it finds like a suitable site, it's going to drive over to that spot. And then the little helicopter is going to deploy from Perseverance's belly. And then Perseverance will drive like, I don't know, about 300 feet away or so, somewhere close, that's not close enough for it to be crashed into if anything goes wrong. That would be a major fail if the helicopter crashes into the rover and damages something. But so they like want to avoid that. But yeah, it'll attempt to actually watch while this helicopter tries to make the first flights on Mars. And it's gee whiz cool, but it's also like NASA wants to see if this will work, you know, because the Mars air is really thin. It's only about like 1% as, you know, sort of thick as Earth's air. So they like think that a helicopter can fly there, but they just want to make sure that it can and that they have the technology to do it. And if this little helicopter does fly, then we could theoretically see like future Mars missions launch with a bunch of helicopters to serve as scouts for a rover or to do scientific investigations on their own. It's just, yeah, it's just really cool. It could pave the way for lots of cool stuff going forward.
I want to wrap up looking at the future. Now, you said Perseverance is collecting samples. The notion that they can end up back here on Earth, brought back by a future mission. So that's not just the challenge of landing something on Mars, but presumably landing something and bringing something back up. How are we going to do that? Or how are we envisioning doing that?
Yeah, it's really challenging. It's never been done before. It's going to have to be, there are like three different spacecraft that have to launch to make this happen. So there'll be like a sample fetch rover, and that's going to be provided by like our European Space Agency partners actually. And that's going to launch with a Mars ascent vehicle, basically just like a Mars rocket. So those two pieces will land close to where Perseverance is and has stored all the samples. And what's going to happen is that fetch rover is going to go over and grab these little sample tubes and haul them back to the Mars ascent vehicle, to the Mars rocket. That Mars rocket is going to launch off the Martian surface with the samples and up to actual Mars orbit. And there it's going to meet up with a third spacecraft that's going to be orbiting Mars. We'll have to launch that one too in the next few years. And it's going to have to rendezvous with that Mars orbiter, which will take the sample canister from the rocket and then haul it home to Earth. So it sounds crazy, right? But I mean, we already have the first part of it going. We're going to get the samples. We have never launched anything off the surface of Mars before, so that's going to be a challenge, but I wouldn't put it past NASA. They're pretty smart.
Finally make fetch a thing. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Mike Wall is a senior writer for space.com. He talked with us today about what the Perseverance rover has been up to in its first month on the surface of Mars. Fear of needles might be keeping some people from getting their COVID vaccine. These days, there are a lot of images floating around online and on the news of people getting jabbed in the arm with needles. For some people, those images might bring feelings of hope and anticipation for their own COVID shot and for life to return to normal. For others, those images are unsolicited exposure therapy to one of their greatest fears. A 2018 study found that 16% of adults avoided getting a routine flu vaccination because of their fear of needles. In a global pandemic where getting vaccinated is the most sure way to protect yourself, we'll talk about this fear and how to deal with it. Mary Rogers is a co-author of the study I mentioned. It's called The Fear of Needles, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. She's an epidemiologist and an emeritus research associate professor in the Department of Internal Medicine at the University of Michigan. She attended, by the way, UW-Madison for her undergraduate studies. Mary, welcome back to Wisconsin. Mary, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, there you are. Hi. Now, you published a study looking at a lot of research out there on the fear of needles back in 2018. How common is this fear?
It is very common in that it is almost universal in preschool children and then decreases as you grow older. So about 20 to 30% of young adults had a fear of needles, and then it decreases as you get a little bit older, but it's fairly common. Although the degree of fear varies. So some people just have mild anxiety, or might be a little moderate, and it really is less than 5%, more around 2% that have an extreme phobia to needles, and those individuals have a definite physical reaction and need medical help. But for a lot of people, it is just generalized anxiety regarding needles.
We'll talk about that 2 to 5% who have that extreme phobia of needles in just a bit. But for the people in that kind of middle category, you're just talking about that anxiety. Do we know to what extent that might motivate them to not get a vaccine versus, okay, I can get over this for this really important vaccine?
Yes, the people that have this needle fear, even if it's mild or moderate, are significantly less likely to go in for vaccines. They're more likely if it's required in their employment, but if they have a choice regarding it, they're much less likely to get one. We found that about 16% of adult patients avoided an influenza vaccine because they had a needle fear. And those individuals were also avoiding pneumococcal vaccine and tetanus vaccines. So people do avoid it because of the fear of needles.
Now, we don't necessarily have research on this because COVID is a once in a 100 years in some ways worldwide pandemic. I guess I just wonder, you know, maybe people wouldn't get that annual flu shot, but with this high profile disease, do you think that will maybe motivate people to be more likely to overcome that anxiety?
Yeah, that's a good question. We don't have a lot of research, but there was a recent nationwide survey on people's intention to get the COVID vaccine that came out recently in the journal Vaccine. And it showed that people that did not get their influenza vaccine were also less likely to like to get a COVID vaccine. And it also showed that certain people were less likely to get it. So for people who had no comorbidities, they were fairly healthy, and they had needle fear, they were less likely to intend to get the COVID vaccine. People who have a lot of comorbidities and are kind of used to going into the doctor for having various procedures, they were a little bit more likely to plan to get the COVID vaccine. So it does kind of depend upon your familiarity with the doctor and doctor's offices and whether you've had blood tests before.
We're talking to Mary Rogers from the University of Michigan Department of Internal Medicine. She has done research on the fear of needles and how common that fear is and how it can affect people's willingness to receive a vaccine, especially if that vaccine is only in needle format. Okay, Mary, we set aside that group of people. You said 2 to 5% who have an extreme fear of needles, something we might call a phobia. If I have a milder anxiety, yeah, maybe you can talk me into something. I have a full-on phobia, it's not going to be as easy, right?
Right. It isn't going to be as easy. And actually, for those individuals who have an extreme physical reaction, it's always recommended to talk with their primary physician or a psychologist or psychiatrist about treatments available. There are recommended guidelines for various cognitive behavioral approaches that use kind of a stepping stone approach to get people more desensitized to needles. And that's usually done in a clinical setting over weeks or months. So that takes some time and it takes initiative to make an appointment to see your psychologist or psychiatrist. I don't know how many people were going to go to that extreme for the COVID vaccine, but the greater percentage are those people that have more of a mild to moderate anxiety regarding needles.
Now, if people might hear this and say, well, 2 to 5%, you know, it's bad news for them if they can't get a vaccine. But in terms of herd immunity, it doesn't sound like that big a number. I don't know how big a difference does it make if we have this population that it's a really tall bar to get them to be able to take an injection.
Yeah, that might be one of the factors. You know, there's a number of factors related to has a hesitancy for getting the vaccine. And it might play into our inability to reach herd immunity if you have a large number of those individuals who just cannot bring themselves to make an appointment. But there are, you know, for those people that have kind of a moderate anxiety regarding this, there are some readily available techniques that ordinary people can use. For example, distraction is one of them. And we use it with children getting vaccines, but it also works with adults. So depending upon what you like to do when you're waiting in line for your vaccine, it might be wise to bring your headphones along and listen to music or do some reading or bring a support person with you to your appointment if you can, or talk to somebody that is a support person on your phone while you're waiting in line. Because one of the anxious provoking situations is when you have to wait. So you make your appointment, you're at Walgreens or Rite Aid. Some people get in right away and they get it done, and that's less nerve-wracking. But if you have to wait for a half an hour, hour or two, that's when people start to become very anxious. So it's better to kind of plan for that. Plan to take your cell phone along and distract yourself by doing something different or having a support person or have something to do while you're waiting. The other thing that might be helpful is when you're watching TV before you get to your appointment, often you'll see these people on the news or on commercials, and they are getting their shot, and you can see the syringe, you can see them getting vaccinated, and that's very anxious provoking for some people just to see the needle. So when that happens, it may be useful to try various relaxation techniques that psychologists use, which means that when you see that and you start feeling anxious, when you see that needle, you just sit down and you take a deep breath and you relax and take another deep breath and relax and do that for a while every time you see a needle. So you begin to associate relaxation with that image. So if it is so fearful for you to see the syringe on TV, you can just try relaxation. Now, that doesn't help everybody, but it might help a few people who, you know, it's more of a mild anxiety.
We'll leave it with that bit of advice, Mary. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure.
That was Mary Rogers, epidemiologist and emeritus research associate professor in internal medicine at the University of Michigan. She joined us for a look at the fear of needles and why that could slow down vaccinations and some advice for people with needle-related anxiety on how to still get that COVID shot.